Time now to have a look at all things health. And I'm joined now by Elizabeth Roddick from New Life Pharmacy. And we're going to be looking behind some of the medical headlines. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Simon.
And plenty going on in the papers and in the media at the moment. One of them, actually, a real one that struck me was, it was one about gum disease. Now, it says a gum disease bug could play a central role in the development of Alzheimer's. Tell us about this.
Yeah, the research was funded by Cortizyme. That's a biotech company. And they involved a wide collaboration of researchers. They looked at post-mortem brain tissue for about 100 people with and without Alzheimer's. And it was something called P. gingivitis bacteria that seemed to be more prevalent in the Alzheimer's brains. And they also wanted to find out if this bug DNA was present in the cerebrospinal fluid, and that surrounds the brain and spinal cord. And finally, they used infected cells to see whether protein that develops in Alzheimer's brains became more prevalent, and then tried inhibiting the growth by destroying those that the sort of subunit that blocks the protein. They were looking at something called gingipanes in the brain of Alzheimer patients compared with those that hadn't had the disease. And the concentration was much higher in the Alzheimer's brains. They also tested clearing the infection, both with an inhibition of the gingipanes, that's what I've just talked about, against a broad spectrum antibiotic, the sort of antibiotic you might take for an infection. Now, the inhibitor was more effective than the antibiotic, and that's interesting. So what can we take from the study is that common mouth bacteria just might play a part in Alzheimer's. But of course, there are lots of different factors as well, as you probably know. Perhaps new drugs may come out of the study, but it is some way off. It's an interesting way of looking of what's happening in Alzheimer's. There's so many factors to look at.
I remember when I was growing up, gingivitis was what the dentist said. If you brushed your teeth and your gums started to bleed, they would say, well, you might have gingivitis.
Yep, you're absolutely right.
So what kind of advice then do you recommend then for a good thorough cleaning of our teeth?
Well, dentists tend to suggest brushing teeth twice a day. Now, you need to be brushing for probably about 2 minutes. And what happens during the day and after a night's sleep is that plaque, and that's the film of bacteria, that builds up on your teeth. Often people ask, is it better to use an electric toothbrush or manual? Really, it doesn't matter. It's more spending the time and your technique. Often dentists have hygienists in their practices, and they can give you some great individual tips for your circumstances. I think don't have too hard a brush. That's one of the things. Soft or medium is best with a small head. And flossing, that's the dental thread to dislodge trapped food. But also it can reduce gum disease and bad breath. It's good to brush your teeth after flossing to brush away the residue. And one of the most effective ways of removing plaque is using these interdental brushes, these tiny brushes. They come in all sorts of sizes, usually differentiated by the colour of the tip. You may need different sizes, a yellow and a blue, depending on how close your teeth are together. Again, your hygienist can give you the right advice. I mean, gum disease, as well as causing bad breath, can also result in loss of teeth and gum abscesses. It's really not a pleasant thing.
And also, bad gum health can lead to things like heart disease as well. They've linked that up as well.
Yeah, we haven't obviously talked about that in this session, but I'm sure I have before, Simon. It's just such a... If you can imagine this bacteria going round your body, it's obviously having effects on all sorts of different areas. And you're quite right, the heart. And now we're reading about this research in the brain.
Interesting. I'm sure we'll hear more on that. Let's move on to another headline, Elizabeth. And it's one, now it's been quite controversial, but it's talking about e-cigarettes. And it says that they are twice as effective at helping smokers give up tobacco than other alternatives, such as nicotine replacement patches or gum.
Yeah, this was a collaborative study from the UK and US, and it was a randomised controlled trial. That's the best type of trial, in order to compare two treatments. The people involved were all adults who'd approached NHS services to get help to quit, and they were chosen from a group that weren't using either the nicotine replacement therapy, that's NRT, or the e-cigarettes. The participants were randomly assigned to either the NRT, the nicotine replacement group, or the e-cigarettes. And they were all offered weekly support as well. Now, that's important because we find that giving up smoking, if you have the weekly support, it's actually much more successful. They also took a carbon monoxide test for the first 4 weeks. Now, that shows if the person had been smoking or not. The replacement group were offered both long-acting products such as patches as well as the short-acting ones. Now, these are things like gum, lozenges, strips. The other group were given an e-cigarette, but with one bottle of the liquid. Thereafter, they had to buy their own, and of course, that's the nicotine liquid. Through the trial, researchers asked questions. Did they use any tobacco? How did they rate the products and whether their breathing was affected? And after 1 year, they then said they asked if they had stopped smoking, and they were asked to take another carbon monoxide test to see if they actually had stopped. And now the results were that 18% of people who'd been given e-cigarettes were non-smokers, although 80% were still using the e-cigarettes, and that's important, whereas 9%, just over 9%, who'd used NRT were non-smokers, with only 9% still using the NRT products. Now, as far as side effects were concerned, the NRT people were more likely to feel a bit squeamish, sick, whereas e-cigarette users reported throat and mouth irritation. I think the fact that the e-cigarette group were almost all still carrying on using them after a year, really don't know the long-term safety of using e-cigarettes. That's one of the problems. They are, of course, undoubtedly much less harmful than actual cigarettes. We still haven't really got to the bottom of all of this. I think I'm always a wee bit wary about e-cigarettes, and clearly you're still, in a sense, addicted to nicotine.
And there are other alternatives, though, aren't there?
Yeah, there's varenicline. It's very effective to stopping smoking, but it does have some side effects, such as nausea, bloating, and some people have trouble sleeping.
Can you get varenicline directly from your pharmacist, then?
It depends whether your local pharmacist has gone through the extra training required. You can obviously check with them. Also, there are some people who it's not suitable for example, a history of psychiatric illness. Now, your doctor would be able to let you know your suitability. But I've certainly found that varenicline is a very effective way of getting people to stop smoking.
Right, well, that's maybe one to get more advice on. Moving on, another headline. A nagging sore throat may be the early sign of cancer. Now, that's not what you want to hear, is it?
No. I mean, cancer of the larynx or voice box probably affects 1,700 people a year. But if discovered early, I mean, it can be treated. That's the point.
So tell us about the research then.
It was a University of Exeter research study. The researchers wanted to know what symptoms people were presenting with before being diagnosed. There's a clinical practice research data link network. Now, that's more than 600 GP practices. And so they were using that. They were looking for community reported symptoms and how often the symptoms cropped up in the GP reports. So they found that hoarseness was the single symptom linked with cancer. 52% of people had reported hoarseness in the year before cancer was found, compared with just a tiny amount, 0.25% of people without cancer. Now, 2.7% of people over 60 who had gone to their GP with a symptom of hoarseness would have had the cancer. Now, if you add the hoarseness, and insomnia is another one, a persistent shortness of breath, mouth symptoms such as difficulty swallowing, permanently sore throat, then the cancer, obviously the diagnosis is raised greatly. About 80% of sore throats tend to be viral. In other words, you won't need an antibiotic. I find benzodiamine a useful spray for a sore viral throat. Unless your symptoms have been carrying on for some time, particularly hoarseness, then you don't need to worry. I think this headline was a little bit of a worrying one because most people get a sore throat from time to time. It's really the length of time you have it and whether it results in a lot of hoarseness over a period of time.
All right. Now, this is one, I know this is close to your heart, Elizabeth, and it's a headline concerning vitamin D. Now, it actually says that vitamin D supplements may be pointless for preventing heart disease and cancer. Now, naturally we get vitamin D from the sun, well, ideally, don't we?
Yeah, that's right. It's produced on the skin by exposure to the sun, but of course it's only in the spring and summer months in the UK, and depending where you live, it's difficult to get enough vitamin D from the source, which is why it's recommended now from the government that people should take 10 micrograms or 400 international units daily. We do know that it's essential for the absorption of calcium to give us strong bones.
But the research is actually saying, though, that it's not any good at preventing the big diseases, though.
Yeah, it was a US study using a randomised controlled trial. A high dose of a daily vitamin D against placebo was given to over 25,000 people. And they checked their vitamin D at the beginning of the study, and 65% of people had high levels at the start of the study. And the results were that there seemed to be no difference in people diagnosed with cancer who'd taken vitamin D as compared to placebo. And again, with heart attack and stroke, there were similar results. I think one of the flaws in the research was that most people had a higher vitamin D level at the start. And that if you look at other studies where people are deficient in vitamin D, then there has been a beneficial effect from taking the supplement. I still suggest to my patients to take vitamin D as a supplement. I think it's very important.
It's got so many other health-giving benefits as well, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not... To me, the name vitamin isn't really good. It's actually a hormonal effect in the body. I mean, it affects the immune system. You know, it's linked to MS, other autoimmune diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, type 1 diabetes. I mean, it's got such a role in the body that really just to call it a vitamin and dismiss it as just something for bones, I think is not correct.
And when you say linked to MS, there have been some linkages to say that a deficiency in it could be have a connection between multiple sclerosis as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that it's high prevalence in the north, particularly northeast of Scotland, where certainly they do get very little sun. So probably vitamin D levels are very low. And I think if you go along to a consultant nowadays, MS or even cancer, probably you will be told to take vitamin D. Now, that's quite new.
Right. Well, we've covered a marathon there of subjects. If you've got any questions on anything Elizabeth's been talking about today, then you can get in touch with me here at RNIB Connect Radio. And you can also get in touch with Elizabeth at New Life Pharmacy. And there's a phone number as well if you want to call.
01416376000.
Elizabeth Roddick, always a pleasure, and I always learn something new. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Simon.